It's 4 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. France says it may have stopped another terrorist attack. The Paris prosecutor says a security force raid early Wednesday in the city may have disrupted a terror unit planning new attacks. The operation occurred near the soccer stadium where one of the attacks that killed 129 people took place last week.
Au total, 8 gardes à vue, c'est-à-dire 7 hommes.
He says 2 people were killed, 8 arrested during early Wednesday operations, 7 men and a woman. Authorities are searching for the suspected mastermind of Friday's attack, Abdelhamid Abaoud, a Belgian of Moroccan descent. The prosecutor says authorities don't have him in custody. 5 security force personnel were wounded during the operation. Meanwhile, French warplanes mounted another day of airstrikes Wednesday, targeting the Islamic State and its de facto Syrian capital of Raqqa. The Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says 33 IS members have been killed by French and other airstrikes in the past 3 days. 2 young female suicide bombers detonated their explosives Wednesday in a marketplace in the northern Nigerian city of Kano, killing at least 15, wounding dozens. It comes a day after another blast in the northeast city of Yola left more than 30 dead. The latest violence was condemned Wednesday by U.S. spokesman John Kirby.
Those responsible for these crimes must be held accountable. The United States renews its commitment to work with Nigeria and its neighbors to defeat Boko Haram and to address violent extremism in the region, countering these attacks on our common humanity.
U.S. spokesman John Kirby, there has been no claim of responsibility for either of the attacks, but suspicion has fallen on the militant insurgent group Boko Haram. The Sunni group is blamed for the deaths of thousands in its 6-year campaign to establish an Islamic caliphate. This is VOA News. U.S. Defense spokesman Colonel Steve Warren said Wednesday that U.S. coalition pilots have begun bombing Islamic State oil trucks after determining strikes on military-controlled oil facilities have been only minimally effective.
In Abu Kamal, we destroyed 116 tanker trucks, which we believe will reduce ISIL's ability to transport its stolen oil products. This is our first strike against tanker trucks, and to minimize risk to civilians, we conducted a leaflet drop prior to the strike, and we did a show of force. We had aircraft essentially buzz the trucks at low altitude.
Islamic State uses millions of dollars in illicit oil revenue to help fund its operations. The IS group has released a photo of what it claims is the bomb that took down that Russian jetliner last month over Egypt's Sinai Peninsula. The photo shows a yellow soda can it claims contained the improvised bomb that brought down the Metrojet Airbus A321, killing all 224 on board. Meanwhile, Egypt's tourism minister, Hesham Zazu, hopes British and Russian flights to his country's tourist sites will resume soon.
Not tomorrow, but for sure in the short run, I believe once we agree both sides on the technical measures taken in terms of security and safety, I believe both sides, the British and the Russians, will reconsider their position and the flights will resume back.
The IS publication says the Russian jetliner was targeted after Moscow began its own air campaign in September against Syrian rebel groups fighting Damascus. Norway's prime minister says the killing of a Norwegian citizen by the Islamic State is a barbaric act. IS militants claim to have killed the Norwegian and a Chinese hostage in their online English language magazine. Angola's foreign minister, Jorge Chacoy, met the U.S. Secretary of State, John Kerry, in Washington Wednesday. Both men discussed regional conflicts in Central African Republic and Burundi.
Angola has been a leader, and the president particularly, with his foreign minister, have really been hands-on in trying to help resolve the problems of neighboring states. Angola plays a very special role. It has a senior leadership stature that has been very important to helping to find peaceful resolution to some of these conflicts.
Angola's government, marking its 40th year of independence, has been criticized for its rights record. President José Eduardo dos Santos, who has ruled for 36 of those years, is accused of overseeing corruption, misrule, arbitrary arrests, and intimidation. The UN says the conflict in Yemen has now claimed at least 5,700 lives. The UN's humanitarian coordinator for Yemen warned of dire times to come as basic services continue to collapse in what has already been the Arab world's poorest country. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barte in Washington. Today is Thursday, November 19th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Uganda awaits the visit of Pope Francis next week.
He is coming to celebrate the golden jubilee of the canonization of the Uganda martyrs, who were canonized by Pope Blessed Paul VI in 1964 in Rome.
John Baptiste Odama is Archbishop of Gulu Archdiocese of Uganda. There is a fresh wave of Burundian refugees fleeing to Uganda. Somalia reopens its embassy in Washington 24 years after. Ethiopian Airlines dispatches its first ever female flight crew. And a Nigerian senator is displeased with public sector corruption.
Since the beginning of the Boko Haram insurgency, some people highly placed in government have turned the whole insurgency into an enterprise for profit-making.
Senator Shehu Sani is the deputy chairman of Nigeria's Senate Committee on Foreign and Local Debt. And French authorities say they thwarted an imminent terror attack during an early morning raid. Those stories, plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. While Pope Francis' planned visit to the Central African Republic remains uncertain because of concerns over security in that country, the government and people of Uganda, where the Pope will visit beginning next Friday, are eagerly awaiting his arrival. The visit to Uganda will be the second by a Pope. The first visit of a Pope to Uganda and Africa in general was made by Pope John Paul VI on July 31st, 1969. John Baptist Odama is Archbishop of the Gulu Archdiocese of Uganda and President of the Uganda Episcopal Conference. He says one of the highlights of Pope Francis' visit to is to celebrate the Golden Jubilee of the canonization of Ugandan martyrs by Pope Paul VI in 1964.
The purpose of his visit, let us put it first, he is coming to celebrate the Golden Jubilee of the canonization of the Uganda martyrs, who were canonized by Pope Blessed Paul VI in 1964 in Rome. We are celebrating that anniversary. He wants to visit the site where the martyrs were burned as a continual sign of encouraging ecumenism in our country and in the church in general. And he has been stressing that very much. Then he has also chance to meet the youth in Kololo Ground. That is the ground, the place of assembly of the youth. He has great love and concern for the sick and the vulnerable people. He will also visit one of the centers where there will be representatives of the sick brought from other parts of the country, and he will have a chance to say some words to them and at least greet them.
I have been wondering, why did the Pope choose to come to Uganda? What is the size of the Catholic population in Uganda?
The population of Catholics in Uganda is quite high, 42%. And then the Anglicans are about 36%. The Muslims are about 14%. And the others are for the remaining groups.
Archbishop Odama, you know that Pope Francis is someone who does not shy away from getting involved or talking about social or political issues. I know in Uganda, there's been the dispute about homosexuality in Uganda. Do you think the Pope is likely to bring this up, or what are the people there thinking?
I doubt whether he will talk about this. I'm not very sure about it, unless you want to know my personal view about it, but I think it is within the teaching of the church. That is where I stand.
Well, what's your personal view on that?
Certainly, I hold the teaching of the church that homosexuality practice of encouraging union is not the correct approach, and those who have this tendency have to be treated with respect, and the church teaching is to have compassion to them and encourage them to have what we call abstinence, or we call it in the church chastity.
Your country is getting very excited about political activities now in preparation for your elections next year.
Yes, that is going on. Now the campaign is in high gear also, and people are excited about it. But we have been constantly, when I say we are saying the church leaders the religious leaders are constantly advising the politicians to handle this situation with the caution, and they must be promoting more of peaceful way of campaigning, not to excite anything of division, of violence, and of, in case, even aggression of killing or anything of that kind.
Archbishop Odama, it's so nice to talk with you, and thank you very much.
You're most welcome. Thank you. God bless you, too.
John Baptist Odama is Archbishop of the Gulu Archdiocese of Uganda and President of the Uganda Episcopal Conference. He was speaking with me from Gulu, northern Uganda. A fresh wave of Burundian refugees has entered Uganda this month amid concerns that violence in Burundi is escalating. Elizabeth Pollard reports for VOA from Mbarara, Uganda, where new arrivals say they fled after pro-government militia and security forces targeted their families.
The Naka Valley Refugee Settlement in southwestern Uganda is home to refugees from all over Central Africa. Ugandan officials say that in the past 2 weeks, around 50 Burundians per day have declared themselves at the border. They suspect the actual number of people arriving is higher due to some bypassing official checkpoints. At Naka Valley, the Burundians have carved out an area they're calling New Bujumbura. Many recent arrivals tell a similar story. They say that although they weren't involved in anti-government protests or political opposition, just knowing someone who was put them in danger. Faisal Sinyurankabo, a 40-year-old car salesman, said he left after the ruling party's Imbonyankore militia killed his parents. He says he isn't political, but his parents were in the opposition. When they were killed, he says he became afraid, and not long after, he left. Janine Kenyamuneza says she fled Bujumbura after her husband and neighbors were killed by militia. She says that while her neighbors were opposition members, her husband had only declined to join the ruling party. She says when she was sneaking over the border, she was afraid of being killed by militias. She first went to Rwanda, where other Burundians helped her get to Uganda. She says she went under the cover of night because she was so afraid. Even today, she is still scared of the Imbonerakure because she heard they are coming to Naka Valley. Ugandan authorities say many refugees worry about this, that militia are pursuing them or watching them in Uganda. The refugee desk officer at the camp said although it is a concern, police and intelligence officers are screening new arrivals and keeping a close watch. Esha Bukanyabuka, a merchant from Bujumbura, says she has been on the run since October. The government arrested her brother, a ruling party member. She says that he escaped and government forces started going after his family. They first moved from house to house in Bujumbura and then up country. But the government kept finding them, so she says they escaped to Rwanda. Yet even there, she says militia tried to find her, so she fled again. In the confusion, she says she was separated from her husband and 5 children. The violence in Burundi began in April amid resistance to President Pierre Nkurunziza's bid for a third term. The UN says at least 240 people have been killed since then. The government has blamed the continued violence on criminals and opponents of the regime. A presidential spokesman did not answer calls for comment Wednesday. Elizabeth Pola for VOA News, Mbarara, Uganda.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington. Today is Thursday, November 19th, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time, 14 minutes past the hour. The deputy chairman of Nigeria's Senate Committee on Foreign and Local Debt says it is unacceptable for public officials to use the fight against the Islamist militant group Boko Haram as a facade to steal public funds. Senator Shehu Sani called on President Muhammadu Buhari's government to widen the net of its ongoing investigation to include governors and senior security officers alleged to be involved in misappropriating funds that are earmarked to fight Boko Haram. Sani, a former civil rights activist who played a key role during initial negotiations with Boko Haram to end the insurgency, tells reporter Peter Clotty that security officers allegedly used the fight against the militants to commit financial improprieties.
Since the beginning of the Boko Haram insurgency, some people highly placed in government have turned the whole insurgency into an enterprise for profit making. They have exploited the security situation in the country to plunder the resources of the country and enrich themselves. The former national security advisor, as well as the one whom he succeeded, and many persons in the government, even state governors, in the last 6 to 7 years, have used the issue of the insurgency as an excuse to steal public funds under the cover of fighting insurgents.
Does that mean that the ongoing fight against corruption should even go to the local governorship and local government officials?
Well, let me tell you the category of looting that has happened under the cover of fighting insurgency. First of all, the governors do allocate heavy sum of money, which they call security votes, for which they simply dip their hands in public till and fill their pocket. That is the governors where the insurgency is happening. And then you see also the police making heavy budgetary demands from the National Assembly. And then you see army generals themselves making also heavy financial requests from government, and also they get such money and it never used on the front line. This is one of the reasons why Boko Haram insurgency refused to go away, because there are people who see it as violence and there are also people who see it as an opportunity to make money. And this is the situation we find ourselves.
Honorable Sani, what has become of the Senate's decision to investigate or to call for an investigation, a thorough investigation into the security issues of Boko Haram, since you said people have profited under the guise of fighting insecurity or fighting Boko Haram to siphon public funds?
Well, let me tell you, I have, as a civil rights activist before I became a senator, I was involved 2 to 3 times in efforts to mediate and bring about an end to this insurgency. And one of my experience in this is that each time we are about to reach a deal to end the insurgency, you see security personnel or security arms of the state sabotaging it.
Senator Shehu Sani is the deputy chairman of Nigeria's Senate Committee on Foreign and Local Debt. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Abuja. Somalia yesterday, Wednesday, reopened its embassy in the United States after 24 years. Speaking at the ceremony, Somalia's foreign minister, Abdi Salam Omar, says the reopening should show the world that Somalia is out of the dark phase of isolation.
This is very important. This is the most important day in the recent history of Somalia. It tells us that we are out of the dark. We are part of the world. We are in Washington, D.C., where decisions are made and issues are resolved. And we are among friends.
That's
here
right.
With us is a Congressman Keith Allison.
Yes, assalamu alaikum.
Secretary of State.
Is there Linda Thomas?
In African Affairs. Oh. So we are with our colleagues and our brothers and our friends and our allies in the United States. And Somalia will never die.
Also speaking at the reopening ceremony was U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield. She said the U.S. will continue to work with Somalia in many fields and areas, including development and governance.
It's going to be great. It's going to be wonderful, and we look forward to working with the government as Somalia continues to build and rebuild for its people. I'm optimistic. I'm very, very optimistic about Somalia's future. I think we've achieved a lot together over the past few years. We have a lot more work to be done, but I think we're going to get there. We're going to work in every field. We're working on the security sector, but we're also working on development, and we're working on governance and helping the country move forward for the election.
That was Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. She spoke Wednesday with VOA's multimedia producer Esra Feseya at the reopening ceremony of the Somali Embassy in Washington after 24 years. French authorities say that police thwarted an imminent terror attack during an early morning raid outside Paris on Wednesday, but two men being hunted in connection with last week's attacks in the French capital were not among those detained following the assault. Lisa Bryant reports from the French capital.
At a news conference Wednesday evening, Paris prosecutor François Molins said the police assault in the Paris suburb of Saint-Denis had neutralized a new terrorist team.
Une nouvelle équipe de terroristes a été neutralisée et tout laisse à penser.
Weapons, organization and determination suggested the assailants were ready to mount a terrorist operation.
Sur place, la conduite des opérations a été rendue extrêmement difficile.
Mullah said at least two people were killed during the assault. Investigators are still trying to identify them, a job made difficult because of the violence of the operation. The building where the assault took place was badly damaged. Also, one of the assailants, believed to be a woman, detonated her explosives vest.
Au total, 8 gardes à vue, c'est-à-dire 7 hommes et une femme, sont donc actuellement
Mullah said France's most wanted men after the attacks, terrorist suspect Salah Abdeslam, and the possible mastermind of the Paris attacks, Abdelhamid Abaoud, were not among those detained. It remains unclear whether either might be among those killed in the assault.
Actuellement, les identités des personnes interpellées dans l'immeuble ne sont donc pas formellement
Mullah
établies.
Mullah offered new details about Friday's terrorist attacks that killed 129 people around the French capital. Salah Abdeslam and his brother Ibrahim, who counted among the suicide bombers in the attack, rented 3 cars from Belgium to carry out the Paris operations. Police found them in different spots around the capital and outskirts with a stash of assault weapons. They also found a cell phone in a garbage can near the Bataclan Music Hall where the bloodiest attack took place, with a text message reading, "Let's go." Speaking to French mayors earlier in the day, President François Hollande announced new measures to fight terrorism both at home and abroad. Life is returning to normal in both Saint-Denis, where Wednesday's raid took place, and in Paris. But residents say they are still shell-shocked. In the 10th arrondissement of Paris, 24-year-old student Frédéric Dumour joined scores of people who lit candles in front of a restaurant and a bar where terrorists gunned down more than a dozen people.
Je sais même pas comment exprimer mes émotions.
Dumour says he feels like he's been personally hit. He said he felt proud today to be Parisian. A few doors down from where the attacks took place, staff and diners at the Bistrot des Oies marked a moment of silence Tuesday night for the victims.
C'est l'attaque de la diligence, comme dans le Far West.
Owner Stéphane Dantier said the shooting was like being in the Wild West. He turned off the lights. People hid under the table. The restaurant has now reopened. We have to carry on, he said, but without a smile. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Ethiopian Airlines is dispatching its first ever flight operated by an all-female crew. The flight was scheduled to depart for Bangkok, Thailand, on Wednesday night. The airline says it wants to promote women's empowerment and encourage more African girls to pursue aviation careers. Martha van der Wolde reports for VOA from Addis Ababa International Airport.
Ethiopian Airlines CEO Tewolde Gebremariam says attracting more women to aviation jobs is one of the reasons for hosting the female flight together with empowering women.
It's going to be very inspiring for all the women all over the world, aviation women, and particularly the African women. Because, as you know, here in the continent of Africa, we are lagging behind in women empowerment. So this is going to inspire all the school girls in Africa that they have a very bright future in the 21st century.
The flight is being handled by women in every aspect, from planning to aircraft maintenance and from the pilots to air traffic controllers. Even upon arrival in Bangkok, all customs and immigration officers will be female. Ethiopian Airlines says about one-third of its employees are women, but the number is smaller when it comes to positions such as pilots and technicians. 22-year-old Haimanot Endale is a cabin maintenance technician and has been working at Ethiopian Airlines for 2 years. She says even though there are many girls working as flight attendants, as a technician, she mostly works with men.
I think that outside of the Ethiopian Airlines, girls think that the work is very difficult. So they are not enter this company, but we enter and We see that it's very easy.
Many Ethiopian women, known for their success in business and politics, attended the event, including Ethiopia's First Lady, Roman Tesfaye. Ethiopian Airlines is Africa's most profitable airline. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa. Sports news here is Mark Olma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Thursday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we focus on football. French tactician Claude Leroy has quit as coach of the Republic of Congo, he told the media in Brazzaville on Wednesday. This comes a day after he guided the Congolese to a 2-1 victory over Ethiopia in Brazzaville in the second round of the Africa 2018 FIFA World Cup qualifiers. The Congolese forge ahead with a 6-4 advantage. Meanwhile, appeals against suspension of FIFA President Sepp Blatter and FIFA Vice President Michel Platini have been rejected, the FIFA Appeals Committee Chairman Larry Musenden revealed in Zurich, Switzerland on Wednesday. Blatter and Platini were suspended from all football activities for 90 days from the 7th of October by the FIFA Independent Ethics Committee. The Ethics Committee is currently investigating a host of alleged inappropriate actions by senior FIFA officials. Blatter and Platini are at liberty to appeal their case before the Court of Arbitration in Sports. Staying in Zurich, FIFA Reforms Committee, headed by Swiss lawyer Francois Carrard, started a 2-day meeting to finalize the reform proposals today, Thursday. Once they complete their work, the proposals will be presented at the FIFA Executive Committee meeting on the 3rd of December. The FIFA Executive may amend certain provisions of the reform package before it is presented at the FIFA Special Congress, where the world's 209 national federations will be in attendance on the 26th of February next year. These reforms are key to the process of restoring FIFA's tainted image. Meanwhile, Chile's Football Association head Sergio Jadu has gone into witness protection to assist the American Federal Bureau of Investigation probing alleged corruption scandals in FIFA, media reports in the Chilean capital Santiago revealed on Wednesday. Jadu, who is also vice president of the South American Soccer Confederation, CONMEBOL, left Santiago with his family heading to New York via Miami. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Nigeria's president has ordered the arrest of a former national security advisor who is accused of stealing billions of dollars meant to buy weapons for the fight against Boko Haram militants. Witnesses tell VOA's Hausa service that police surrounded the house of Sambo Dasuki in the capital Abuja and are refusing to let him leave despite a judge's ruling that Dasuki can go abroad for medical treatment. Dasuki was the national security advisor to former President Goodluck Jonathan, who current President Muhammadu Buhari defeated in the March elections. The government said Tuesday that between 2012 and 2015, Dasuki awarded fake contracts worth more than $2 billion for fighter jets. Meanwhile, two explosions rocked a market in the Nigerian city of Kano on Wednesday, causing an unknown number of casualties. That's it for this Thursday, November 19th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very good day.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, Pope Francis travels to Africa. Making his first trip to the continent, the pontiff will visit Kenya, Uganda, and the Central African Republic in a pilgrimage that will bring him face to face with Islamic extremism and Christian-Muslim violence. Join host Shaka Sali and his guests as they discuss the significance of the Pope's mission next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on VOA Africa. Next on Let's Talk, high heels and women. Is it a symbol of beauty? Join host Sunday Shomari and his guests discussing high heels and women. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest with some hilarity. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.